Well, hey everybody, let's get started. I'm Jason Anderson. I am the Group Program Manager for the Open Source Technology Center at Microsoft. And we do a bunch of things in OSTC. We actually have a very geo-dispersed group as well. We have a group in Redmond, and we have a group in Shanghai. And I know that I look Chinese, but I'm part of the group in Shanghai, believe it or not. And our job is to really make Linux, FreeBSD, open source solutions in general work great on Hyper-V and work great in Azure. So I'm going to talk about that a bit today and talk a little bit more about what we're doing from a roadmap perspective in terms of how we think about investing more in Linux and FreeBSD, and also in terms of how we focus on that for Azure as well. So let's go ahead and jump into it. So the first question that you may ask is, Microsoft, why do you care about Linux? Why do you care about non-Windows operating systems? And while for many years we've had some challenges with that from a perception perspective and so on, the reality is that our customers, all of our enterprise customers, have heterogeneous environments. Very rarely do any of our customers run 100% Windows Server on the back end. It's closer to around 75%. But there's still a good majority of Linux-based workloads that our customers are running. And what we've heard consistently from our customers is that we need to do a better job supporting those workloads like we do with Windows. And we've done a significant amount of work to help close that gap, so I'll talk about that. So that's the first thing, is making sure that Linux and FreeBSD, which is relatively new, runs great on Hyper-V and runs great in Azure. So what does that mean? What does a best experience, what does great mean? What it means is that we have the level of performance, level of stability that you would expect from a Windows VM versus being on bare metal. So having an experience with Linux and FreeBSD that's similar to what you get on bare metal is really what our goal is. Second is ensuring that our customers also have great availability and flexibility in terms of what Linux distros they want to run in their environment. So rather than just focusing on one particular distro, we do our best to work with our customers and understand what's really popular in the enterprise environment and drive our roadmap and plans to support those as primary targets. So ensuring that level of flexibility is there is super important as well. And then lastly, being able to make sure that you can easily manage and extend those workloads, whether it's through System Center, which Michael Kelly gave a session earlier today on how we manage how we do a great job managing Linux workloads and System Center and App Manager, but also extending through hybrid scenarios to the cloud, and so on. So that's really the key goals for what we're doing. And this is an effort that's really built up significantly in the past couple of years. And maybe before I jump into that, it'd be actually a good view to find out how many of you are running or managing Linux workloads today in your environment, your customer's environment, or whatnot. Any raise of hands? Okay, significant. For those of you that haven't, you're probably here maybe just out of curiosity, or or maybe you have plans to move that way. But in the past couple of years, we've done a tremendous amount of work to really beef up our support for Linux. And really what that means is getting to that level of performance and stability. And we'll talk through, you know, what that actually is. So I'm going to start with a little bit of a kind of hypervisor 101. So I apologize if this is very basic for probably most of you. We actually get this question a lot about what non-Windows operating systems can run on Hyper-V and what we focus on. So let me just walk through this really quick. The first question in the decision tree is, does your operating system that you want to run on Hyper-V, is it x86 or x64 based? Is it Intel instruction set operating system? If no, it's not going to run on Hyper-V. It's that simple. So if you're taking a look at Solaris Spark or HP Unix or AIX or even Windows RT for that matter, it's not going to run on Hyper-V, okay? The answer is yes. The next question is, are there integration services for that operating system you want to run? If no, then what you get is a emulated devices experience. Effectively, you get an experience where you can provision and run that VM. But you're going to lack a lot of the integration with Hyper-V for manageability and features and functionality. And really, you're going to run into issues with performance, whether it's networking or storage. It's going to be a significant drawback. So I'll actually show some of that a little bit later on. So for example, Linux without integration services, BSD without integration services, or Solaris x86 for that matter, would be in an emulated mode. If yes, if you have integration services, then you get the full experience, and then you get the opportunity to have a scenario where your Linux workload is going to be potential to performance and stability that you would have on bare metal. Okay, you get full Hyper-V integration, and the features that we introduce with new versions of Hyper-V coming out work well, actually work with those operating systems, and you get the manageability hooks and functionality hooks that you'd need to be able to manage those workloads in a more systematic, controlled way. So that's the start. So let's talk a little bit about what integration services are, and that's the majority of what the content will be today, is talking about really how we are investing in integration services. It's really the key that makes Linux and FreeBSD work on an OS. So to start, the way a hypervisor works in general is it presents effectively synthetic devices up to the guest OSs. So your hardware that you're running your Hyper-V host on, you've got network interface cards, you've got probably not really video cards, but storage controllers and so on. Those devices need to show up to the guest OS just as if they were real. So Hyper-V through VMBus presents those devices up to the guest OS. And the guest OS needs drivers for those devices. So just as you have drivers for your hardware on your host operating system, in the guest OS there need to be drivers for those synthetic devices as well. That's where integration services comes in. So if you don't have drivers for those devices, effectively, when I talked about before in the previous slide, having an emulated mode, if you will, you get kind of a baseline experience. And a way to equate that would be we ship Windows today with a whole bunch of drivers in box, as an example. But we also ship a base VGA driver or a base video driver in Windows today. In the event that you're running your video driver and you get a crash, you don't lose video. We'll go down to that base driver, which gives you very basic functionality, 1024 by 768, limited color depth, and so on. That particular driver has to be able to run effectively on any video card in the market. So it's a lowest common denominator driver. And as such, you don't get any advanced features. You don't get the graphics acceleration. You don't get the color depth. You don't get the resolution and so forth. So that's why when you see that scenario happen, and you probably have seen this before where your graphics adapter driver crashes and your screen resolution changes for a while and then it recovers and comes back, that's similar type of experience of what you would get in Linux or FreeBSD without integration services that have an emulated device. You have that base level of broad compatibility. So if you think about that, for example, from a networking perspective, you're going to be, in order to have a base synthetic driver for a network in the guest OS, you're going to be limited to effectively network cards that are 20 years old, right? So you're going to be at very, very super slow speed. So really something that you can't deploy production workloads on. So again, integration services are the component layers, or effectively are the drivers for the Hyper-V guest OS, okay? And they have to follow the driver model for that guest OS. So that means that you can't, there's Linux integration services for Linux, there's integration services for FreeBSD, they're not the same, okay? It's just as, and there are integration services for Windows as well, so they're all separate. So each guest OS needs to have its drivers for its driver model and devices in order to be able to take advantage of that acceleration and the functionality that we present through Hyper-V. So there's your integration services 1.0. Let me jump into a quick demo to kind of demonstrate what this looks like. Okay. So I've got, if I can find my mouse, oh, I got to actually grab the right mouse. That would help. Okay. I've got a CentOS 6.3 image running right now. And so CentOS 6.3 is an example of a guest OS that, out of the box, if you will, does not have integration services installed. So as you can see, the VM's running. You can see UI and disk is working and so forth. But you notice a few things that are compromising. The first one is my mouse pointer. Now, I know that you can't see my mouse, but if I move my mouse, it's stuck within this window, okay? So it's basically an emulated mouse device. If I do, if you see in the bottom left corner here, it says to release your mouse, press Control, Alt, left arrow. So I'll do that. And what you're going to, that's the wrong keyboard dummy. Okay. If I do that, you'll see that now my mouse pointer is broken free and I have this dot here. And then I can now move the mouse outside of the window itself, okay, as an example. Okay. Another example is, actually I need to, is Hyper-V services don't work. So I'm in Hyper-V Manager here, and inside of my connection window, if I try to do a shutdown, it's not going to work. The integration services, for example, are what provide the interface and hooks into the kernel to be able to do an orderly shutdown from Hyper-V Manager. So whether I'm automating this through PowerShell and whatnot, without integration services, I've got no way to remotely to do that in a systematic way. So just for comparison, let me go ahead and just cold turn this thing off. I'm going to apply a checkpoint here of with integration services just to show the difference in experience. And again, that we're showing UI here. This is not what you would deploy from a server workload perspective, but I wanted to visually demonstrate some of the basic functionality integration services provide. Okay, so the first thing you'll see is that, hey, look, my mouse actually now transverse outside the window, okay, and I can go ahead and do a shutdown. Pretty straightforward, so I'll go ahead and let that continue. All right, switch back to the PowerPoint. Wow. That was me trying to switch over to my, let's see. Bear with me here. I'm having keyboard confusion issues, and now I'm completely screwing up that presentation. So this is not part of the demo. This has nothing to do with Linux. This is completely a Windows issue. Actually, this is a user issue. If there's anybody back there from the tech support AV group that could give me a hand, I would appreciate it. Yeah, that's what I'm doing, and it's now not rotating anymore.
Control out it down, up. Yes.
Let's try one more. Get focused on this screen. Look at that magic. Thank you. Okay. That was fun. All right. So let's talk specifically about Linux integration services and some of the work that we've done there to make that experience for Linux better. Let's start first with how Microsoft develops Linux integration services, how we provide it to our customers. There's effectively two ways that we deliver the driver packages to customers. The first way, and it's dependent upon the version and the age of Linux that you're running, and I'll walk through the matrix in a second. But if you're running older versions of Red Hat-based kernels, as an example, what you can do is you're going to go up and you're going to download our Linux Integration Services package from the Microsoft Download Center onto your distribution and go ahead and install it manually, and you get integration services. Okay? But the model that we've been working on for a number of years for newer distributions and newer distro vendors that are coming on board is just working directly with the community, where we go ahead and submit changes and upstream them into Linux main kernel. And then we work closely with distribution vendors to then include that those changes, that kernel changes, into their kernel as well and push out. So we talk about the level of work we do with distro vendors. It varies. We try to get as much coverage as we can, but we work very closely with a few, again, based on the popularity of what's in market. So this is not a complete list. It's an example of some of the distro vendors that we work with. But the beauty of this is, as a customer, for these newer distro versions, you don't have to worry about do you have the correct version of Linux Integration Services installed or not. It all just works. Now, support issues will then flow in the reverse direction. So if you have issues that are related to Linux in general, as an example, you would go back to your distribution vendor. But if you have issues that are related to Hyper-V interactions and just integration services in general, then you'd work with Microsoft. So let's talk about what our supported Linux distros are and the matrix and how it works out. So I kind of broke this out based on the type of kernel that exists. So Red Hat-based kernel operating systems, like obviously Red Hat Enterprise Linux and CentOS and Oracle Linux as well, The versions kind of vary. So older distros, such as 5.5 to 5.8 and 6.0 to 6.3, you have to download the Linux Integration Services package from the Microsoft Download Center to get that functionality. But for newer versions, so 5.9 and up, and then Oracle Linux 6.4 and up, it's built in and certified. So Red Hat certifies and puts it on their website, and so does Oracle. Now, Oracle also has another version of Linux where they have their own kernel, their unbreakable enterprise kernel, and they build in their they build in our integration services into that kernel natively, and they certify it as well. Now, for other distros that just take from Linux main generally and don't do massive changes from a kernel perspective, like Ubuntu, Debian, and then SUSE, you can see the versions that are there. Those are all built in. So the Linux Integration Services package, you don't need to install on any of those versions. Now, what's new? So over the past 6 months plus, new versions have come out and we've updated. So obviously for Red Hat CentOS 6.6 and 7.0, which are all relatively new, we've got updated changes that are in there. I'll walk through that here in a minute. Oracle Linux QU3 and then Ubuntu 14.10 and SUSE Linux Enterprise Server 12 all have those built in. So the goal is that going forward, as we work with these vendors, that all new versions will have integration services built in natively. Let's talk a little bit about the Linux Integration Services package. Okay, so not the upstreamed built-in changes by the distro vendors, but what we provide by the Microsoft Download Center. As far as how we think about planning, so just to be clear, the latest version of the LIS package does not have all of the features and functionality necessarily that what would be built into kernels that have it built in natively. The reason being is that we need to maintain compatibility with older kernels, so some functions will not be available, and I'll give you some examples of that. So the key thing is to maintain compatibility, but to bring forward new features where we can that will work with those older kernels. So we want to continue to advance based on that. And this is all data-driven based on conversations, again, that we have with our customers, what we hear in the industry in general as far as the level of workloads that are still out there. So there's a lot of folks that are still running 6.0 to 6.3 as an example, or 5.x on the Red Hat side as well. So ensuring that we continue to innovate and provide updates for newer versions of Hyper-V is important for those packages as well. Now, as far as what Linux distros that we target for LIS packages, first of all, a broad statement. All of the work that we do with regards to Linux Integration Services, both on the packaging side as well as upstreaming, is really focused on the server versions of the Linux OSs. Okay? Now, where there are corresponding desktop versions, which most do, chances are that they're going to work, and they provide those, if they're built in, we'll provide those in the kernel natively, or the LIS package will work. But all the certification and testing that Microsoft does in conjunction with our distro partners are done on the server side. So that's the first thing, is we focus on server. And obviously, the Linux Integration Services package is only for distros that are not built in. So if you have an older distro if you have a newer distro, for example, that has all the changes upstream, but a newer version of Linux Integration Services comes out that has new features enabled, you can't just take that package and apply it to that existing version that has LIS built into it. And the reason being, you'd have to recompile the kernel and so on to do that, in which case, some cases it might work. But we check to make sure that we only bring forward features that will work on those particular versions. So it's about maintaining compatibility and stability. So let's talk about some of the new features that we've been working on lately that we've been upstreaming. This is kind of representation over the past year plus of work that we've done. On the left-hand side, you see the version of Hyper-V Server and the features that are associated, and going forward, kind of the work that we've done. And let me just state that, first of all, the work that we're doing, frankly, we're in a lot of catch-up mode, trying to get to the point where Linux has the level of support that Windows does. So we are aggressively expanding our teams. In fact, if anybody is interested in a Linux job at Microsoft, talk to Michael Kelly. He's hiring. We're hiring on PM and on the engineering side. But we're aggressively trying to close that gap. It is of strategic importance, as Satya Nadella has been talking about recently as well, and just presented a slide about Microsoft loving Linux. It's strategically important for Microsoft as a company to have the level of support for Linux and FreeBSD that we do for Windows. So it's a very high priority item. And so we're rushing hard to get those features upstreamed and closing that gap. So you're going to see things like, for example, TCP offload, which is a 2008 R2 feature, we just upstreamed this spring and have made available in newer kernels. Okay. 2D video driver, that's a little bit of an older one. That's actually been going on for a while, but trying to get better performance for 2D video for those that are running an actual GUI on their server version, or if you're running a desktop version. For 2012 and up, dynamic memory hot add we introduced last year. That's the ability to go ahead and change the amount of RAM that you've got associated with that VM while the VM is up and running. It's a pretty important feature. Virtual receipt side scaling. That's a key one that we just introduced as well in terms of network performance. There's a lot of things that we've done to increase networking performance, as it's been a huge gap that we've had on the Linux server side. VRS is an example of that, where effectively we can spread the load of the virtual network adapter across multiple virtual processors that you've got associated with that VM to help increase throughput and be able to bring just performance up in general. And then 2012 R2 Plus, the first one is Gen 2 VM support. And this is critical for a lot of things, whether it's the first key thing that we've enabled is UEFI boot mode. And we'll talk about some features in vNext that are coming up that are important for this. File copy from host to guest, pretty straightforward. Trim support, this is important for Azure in terms of being able to optimize storage consumption through thin provisioning and such. So this is a pretty key investment as well. Online VHDX resize, so you're able to now, Linux VMs are able to dynamically change. You can change the size of your VHD while the VM is running rather than having to shut it down. Virtual fiber channel support, and then online backup support for backing up your VMs, live VMs to Azure. Now, what are we working on right now? Okay. One of the key ones that Tudor will talk about and his experiences with is what we're calling enhanced time synchronization. In reality, we're just trying to make time synchronization work. Well, we've got a pretty significant clock drift issue between the guest and the host today in Linux VMs, which can be exacerbated by how much how much CPU utilization on that VM is actually running. And the way it works today is we synchronize the host and the guest every time the guest boots up. So if you've got a long runtime VM, for example, a lot of CPU, clock drift can be significant, and actually within minutes it can be significant. So we're making some changes in upstreaming right now to change that methodology to do, number one, preferably to use NTP to go ahead and synchronize with the net. But if you still want to be able to set up an interval to regularly synchronize with the host to make sure that you're in sync. So we're working on that now and hope to have that upstreamed and actually available relatively soon. I talked about network performance. Again, this is a key area that we've been working hard at. So this is in progress, and I think we are in progress of getting this actually upstreamed as well. Key thing here is we've been seeing in the past network performance on 10 gigabit cards, for example, of being really more around 2, maybe 3 gigabits per second. We're now at a point where we're up to 9-plus gigabits. Which is fantastic, but that work's not done. So we're getting that upstream, so that's available, but as we get into even larger environments and faster throughput, like up to 40 gigabits, we've got more work to do there as well. We're working on this too. So this is a high priority item, and this is gonna be continuing over time. So for 2012 plus SRIOV, this is again another network throughput optimization that we're just kicking off right now. Now the Windows Server vNext features. I'm not going to dive into these deeply because I'm going to jump into a demo in a second, but the first one is secure boot, so ensuring that you've got a trusted path between the boot from the UEFI from the firmware side all the way up to the operating system, so malicious software, whether it being a bootloader or another operating system, can't interrupt that sequence and actually infect and compromise your VM. So that's a pretty key one. And then being able to hot add or remove synthetic network adapter cards while your VM is running. And so the real scenario there is adding, so I'll talk about that in a minute. And then Azure, which is interesting because Azure is actually based off of Hyper-V. It's a little bit of a different version of Hyper-V, so there's some differences there. But we're doing some significant work, which Mark Rosinovich demoed, I think it was on the first day of the keynote, around being able to do things such as Azure Batch and being able to do high-performance computing up in Azure. So InfiniBand support enables us to be able to take advantage of the InfiniBand hardware we have in Azure, specifically for Linux guests. So as we think about running high-performance computing, we're looking at compute nodes not only being Windows, but also Linux as well, and having the flexibility for our customers to choose what they want to have. So InfiniBand support's critical to be able to support that scenario. So with that, let's go ahead and jump into a couple of demos. Let's first, I'll do secure boot. I talked about really what it is, so let me just jump into the demo here, and hopefully I won't completely screw up my presentation again. Okay. So the first thing I'm going to show you, so I've got a VM here that I've called Test Secure Boot. If I take a look at the settings here of this VM, as a part of being a Generation 2 VM, you have the ability to enable Secure Boot. And in this case, it's actually enabled by, when you create a Gen 2 VM, it'll be enabled by default. Okay. And so it's enabled. So what I'm going to go do right now is jump over to PowerShell. And let's take a look and see what my VM status is right now. I keep on doing that. Okay. So right now you can see, as I went ahead and did a get firmware, I don't have a secure boot template. Okay. So even though I have secure boot enabled, I don't have the certificate associated with the UEFI firmware. Okay. So what's going to happen then if I fire this VM up? Only one way to find out. We're starting it up, it's going to go through the process, and as you see, it's blocked by Hyper-V and even being able to boot. So what you'll notice here is that it's saying that no UEFI compatible file system was found, and that the image's hash certificate were not allowed. So effectively, we don't have the certificate associated, it blocks the boot. So this is, even though the certificate's not here, in a case where you actually had an intrusion, it would find that and do the same. So let me go back and let me turn this VM off. And let's go back to PowerShell, and I'm going to go ahead, and I've got a certificate that is associated with this firmware. I'm going to associate it with this firmware. It's on the system. So I'm going to go ahead, and I'm going to set the firmware for this VM Test Secure Boot using the Secure Boot template of the Microsoft UEFI Certificate Authority. So as I go ahead and run that, okay, let's go ahead and check and see if our firmware has actually been updated. Okay, great. So now it's saying that I've got a secure boot template for the certificate authority that's signed. So let's go ahead now and let's fire up this VM. Start it back up. And now it's bringing me to the bootloader and the boot option. This is actually an install ISO, so it's not a full running, but I can go now and install Ubuntu and get running. So the certificate was validated and it actually worked. So switching back over, my PowerPoint. Now let's talk about HAT add remove network interface adapter. The key scenario here to want to hot add a NIC would be if you're in a scenario where you want to increase the workload on a particular VM, and you want to do some level of affinity between network adapters for workloads, as an example. And in the past, you've not been able to do that, and this is a new feature in general. So being able to actually have this at the same time that we're doing with Windows Server vNext is pretty cool, actually. It's the first time that we're able to actually get these two synchronized up together and be able to release. So let's go ahead and pop over and take a look at what that scenario looks like. So I've got another Ubuntu VM running here. Let's go ahead and take a look at the settings here. Again, it's a Gen 2 VM, okay? So I'm at the add hardware. I've got network adapter as an option. Actually, before I do that, let's boot this VM up first. So just to show that it's actually a Gen 2 VM, showed you that. Let's boot it up. It's already up, okay. And if I go ahead and do an ifconfig, you can see that I've only got one Ethernet adapter here, so ES0, ETH0 is the only adapter that I've got, okay? So it's still running. Let's go back here. I'm going to go to the settings of the VM again, and I'm going to go ahead and add another adapter. So let's add. Connect it to my virtual switch. Hit apply. Okay, so now you're going to see that I've got two network adapters listed here in the settings for my VM. Great. Let's go back to my VM now. If I do, I think it's going to show, yep, okay. So now it's showing Ethernet 0 and Ethernet 1 are both enumerated in the VM. The VM never went down. So this is a great scenario as you want to continually add more functionality to your VM. You notice there's a lot of features here that we're trying to get caught up on that tries to eliminate downtime for your VMs. As you're running production workloads, the most disruptive thing you can do, besides having your VM crash, is actually have to shut it down for simple maintenance tasks. So the more that we can do this, the better. Okay, so switching back over. So let's talk about the feature availability in general. This information is all up on TechNet. It's in the resources slide, so you can go there and go through scrutiny. But I wanted to try to provide a somewhat simplified version across the board of what our feature availability looks like today. So the way this chart is laid out, I've got our different releases of Linux distros up at the top. And then availability means, is Linux integration services, are they actually built in as an upstream? Or do you need to have Linux integration services package installed? So today, the current version or the latest version of Linux integration services is 3.5. We're currently working on a 4.0 version right now, and we're going to talk through some of the features that we're enabling for that. And again, that's almost exclusive for Red Hat-based kernel 6.0 to 6.3. So even though it says TBD here, we could theoretically add more, but we don't have any data that says that we need to do that at this point. But if we do, we'll update. So key things here are, as you can see, our VRSS, as I talked about, and TCP offload. Those have made it into Red Hat Enterprise Linux 6.6, Ubuntu 14.10, and Celeste 12. And it's also going to be part of our LIS 4.0 package. So you might ask the question, well, why isn't in Red Hat Enterprise Linux, CentOS, and Oracle Linux 7, or Oracle UEKQ3? Well, the way Linux versioning works is, sometimes the dot versions will get out quicker than the major versions from just a fix and update perspective. So we didn't quite hit the window for 7 and QU3 for these particular features to be upstreamed, but they'll be upstreamed in the dot releases for those particular versions. And then going on from a storage perspective, and this is really a view over the past year, so a lot of the stuff you may already be familiar with and have seen if you're running Linux on Hyper-V today, but a good majority of the functionality that we have on Hyper-V in the storage side is already upstreamed and available. But what's relatively new is it talked about VHDX resize, Viper channel support, and live virtual machine backup. And then trim support. Trim support's interesting. You see it's only on Ubuntu 14.10 and not across the board. You might ask the question, well, why is that? Actually, the work that we did here, and we worked with the community to get upstreamed into kernel, didn't get accepted for a couple of different reasons. I know we worked through with them on, but Ubuntu was interested enough that they took the source and kind of did it themselves and built it in. So it's really not a part of our Linux integration services package, if you will. They went ahead and did that version and updated it and kind of made it their own, made it available themselves. We get to vNext Windows Server, it's going to be a core part of that and will be available across the board. And then dynamic memory hot add has been relatively new for, again, Red Hat 6.6, Ubuntu, and Celeste 12. We had one particular bug that we're working through with Oracle. It didn't make it into QU3, should be in QU4. And this is an example of one that's not going to be in our LIS package for 4.0. And the reason being is that dynamic memory hot add's not going to work with older kernels, so we can't bring that feature available. So trying to install that, make it work, would just cause problems anyway, so it's not available. Okay. So moving forward, so we talked about the video work that we did on 2D driver. That's across the board, relatively new. File copy from host to guest, which is relatively new across the board. Didn't quite make it into QU3 as well, but we'll get it into QU4 with Oracle. And that will be a part of our LIS 4.0 package. And then boot using UEFI. So this is not secure boot. Secure boot is vNext, so it's obviously not showing here because we don't have it upstream because we're relying on vNext for it to be there. This is just being able to boot using UEFI firmware for your VM. That's just currently available for Linux, Oracle Linux 7, 14.10, and Celeste 12. We think it's, so I have TBD for Oracle UEK QU3 because we're in the process of validating it right now. It should work, but I don't have test results back from my team. So it should be working. And that will be a part of our LIS 4.0 package as well. Okay, so enough about me talking about Linux on Hyper-V. Let's actually hear from somebody who's doing it. I want to introduce Tudor Damian, who is one of our Hyper-V MVPs and one of the few guys that we work with closely who's been running Linux on Hyper-V a lot longer than a lot of us have. So he's got a couple things he wants to share with us. So I'm going to turn it over to Tudor for a couple minutes.
All right. Thanks. So what I'm going to be talking about a bit is some of my experience working in the IT industry and dealing with running Linux on Hyper-V. We've had customers in both the hosting industry and IT services running Linux ever since the very, very first release of Hyper-V. And we've had to deal with all the pain and all the issues of running Hyper-V with Linux at a moment when the integration services were really not covering all these new shiny things that Jason talked about earlier. So what I would like to touch a bit here is there's a lot of disconnect as to what's supported in which versions, which distros of the Linux kernel should I look at, which versions of the kernel should I take, because there is this transition that occurred over the past few years, moving over from just getting the Linux integration services or integration components, as they used to be called, and installing them manually. And at first, when you had version 2.1, you would get this and you would have a Perl script that would actually recompile the Linux kernel. So you'd have to install the tools in the backend to allow you to compile the kernel if you wanted to have the integration services inside your virtual machines. Eventually, that changed to a much easier way of doing things with RPM packages, for instance, and it's way, way easier to just install them right now. However, and there's been a lot of discussion about this and a huge lack of documentation up until recently. It's actually, I think, a year ago or less than a year ago that relevant articles have started showing up on TechNet with grids telling you exactly what's supported in each version of the kernel. And this happens because people were really interested in knowing this piece of information. I was contacted over and over by customers and people knowing me to let them know, hey, I'm still running version, 6.2 of CentOS, and I need to know what I'm able to run because I'll probably not upgrade anytime soon. Even if I'm looking at older version, 5.x, I'll probably not go to a newer major version. I'll just stick to this one. So I need to know what I'm able to run and how I'm going to be able to do that. And in some cases, you would have to get the integration services and install them manually. In some other cases, you probably caught one of the distros that had the drivers in there, but they were in the staging area of the kernel. So you had the drivers, but they're not starting up when the system boots up. You'd have to go in and manually enable them on boot, reboot the machine, and get the support that was there. This was because when these pieces of codes first starting going into the Linux kernel, they went into the staging area. They had to be validated. And a lot of things stood there for quite a while. And even if you had them, you would not get them on boot. So that's one thing that's worth mentioning. You should really look into reading up on what's supported if you plan to use older versions of the Linux distros. If you go with the newer ones, you're good. But if you're somewhere in between, or if you're using the old ones, you might have some issues figuring out what you need to do. Then there's the time sync that Jason mentioned. We've seen this even before TimeSync was even supported in the integration services. The way TimeSync works right now is it only does a TimeSync when the system boots up. And after that, the operating system itself would try to match the CPU cycles and get that time based on CPU cycles, just like a physical host would do. But what happens is, and this is something that I've seen happen with a hoster that we were working with at the time, they actually went ahead and put up a 16-node Linux Hyper-V cluster running 95% Linux on it, because as hosters, they were looking to get the cheapest solution out there. Hyper-V server was free. They put it in a cluster and spin up some Linux VMs. And as hosters, they would constantly try and push their hardware to the limit, so they would fill up those machines with a lot of servers for the customers. The CPU load would go up, and we would see time drifts of up to 2 seconds per second. So the time, within 10 seconds, it would be 20 seconds off of the real time. And what the hoster ended up doing is they ended up telling all their customers, if you need to somehow keep this in check, you would have to run NTP inside your guest and do a cron job to do that every 10 seconds or every 15 seconds just to try and keep that time sync in check. And this is still happening with the current version. It's way, way better. It's gotten significantly better over time. But if you start up a server and you leave it running for, say, a few days, a few weeks, you might see drifts of 30 seconds, 1 minute, 2 minutes, and you might see software failures caused by this, because if that piece of software relies on communicating between two hosts that have the same timestamp on everything, if the timestamp is significantly different, you'd get disconnects, you'd get errors in your applications. Another thing worth noting is, since this might be new territory for some of you out there, if you start running Linux workloads on Hyper-V and you start running into issues, it might not always be a Hyper-V issue. And I can give you another example here. We worked with an ISP that at some point started moving their Linux infrastructure on a Hyper-V cluster. And one of their routers was also running a Debian squeeze, I think it was 3.5 something, a custom version of the kernel that they compiled themselves to get the latest stuff in there. And what they saw is that on a 1 gig NIC, they were only able to push around 100 to 200 megabits of data. So that's 5 to 10 times lower than the actual capacity. And they started looking at, hey, maybe the network driver is faulty. Maybe there's something wrong there. And we had a couple of back and forth with the Microsoft team in charge of the Linux stuff at the time. And they said, well, you could try and increase the ring buffer on the network card and increase the number of the limit of sessions, active sessions. And we tried all that, and it wasn't working. And it wasn't until 2 days later that we figured out that they actually had a setting in their firewall with a session hard limit. And since a lot of sessions were going through there, the firewall itself was just blocking all the traffic, all the extra traffic. And they assumed, well, it's the Hyper-V network drivers that are at fault. There's another case where there was a fault with the network card drivers. Another company had, they were running, yet again, a Debian cluster, two hosts doing some really fancy bridging stuff. And every now and then, they would get an error in the error log stating that the Hyper-V network driver just dropped a packet. And at times it would recover, but sometimes they would have to actually reboot the machine to get the network working again. And again, we tried contacting the Microsoft team who were working on that piece of code and pushing changes to the Linux kernel. And they figured out that, yes, it was an actual issue with the way they were handling things, in that the transmit queue
used to be stopped when it hit the limit. And if you'd fill up the network queue in the ring buffer, you would just have all the extra packets dropped and had to be resent from the upper layer again just to confirm that the packet has been delivered. And this would cause disconnects. And what they did is they made a minor change in which they had the transmit queue stop when the threshold was at a low end, but not full, which would still allow place for some extra packets to go in there. So even if the transmit queue was filling up, at some point they would just stop it, but it would still allow some of the extra packets still coming in over the wire to be queued up until the actual limit. And this would eliminate some of the overhead of retries and disconnects that were caused by this. This was pushed into the Linux kernel. It was, at that time, delivered, I think it was 3.5 RC7, the Debian kernel. They just grabbed that kernel manually, recompiled their kernel with that version, and the error was gone. So there is work to be done. Even if you discover something, you might just say, well, it's not working, I'm just going to, I don't know, go and switch to another solution. But if you just take your time and perhaps contact Microsoft about this, it only took, I think, 5 days at the time to get the fix pushed into the kernel and delivered to the customer via the kernel itself. So it's fairly easy to find ways to make things work. Now, this is stuff from, I think, 2 years ago. So ever since then, a lot of extra patches have gone through. And if you are using any of the newer Linux distros, you're probably fine and won't have to deal with this type of situation. But back then, this used to be an issue. And even so, if right now, if you're using Linux in your infrastructure, how many of you are using the latest distros? All right, very few out of the many more that raised their hands stating that, yes, they were using Linux. Because usually it's one of those things that you set and forget. If it's running, I won't touch it. And a funny thing, I was talking to Jason earlier. Back in April when Heartbleed was all the rave, they announced, hey, we've discovered this bug in OpenSSL, this is serious. We started telling our customers about it, even the ones that didn't have managed services, and we didn't manage their infrastructure for them, and we just notified them, hey, this is a serious thing, you should patch your systems. And we've had several emails come back and say, well, we haven't patched in 2.5 years, so we didn't manage to get the bug, which was released back in, I think, March 2012. It was running there undiscovered for over 2 years. So if you follow the rule to patch regularly, every time you get a new version, you patch immediately, and you run the latest version of things, you would have been vulnerable to Heartbleed back in March 2012. The people that didn't patch their systems would not be vulnerable to that thing. And they just said, well, we don't need to worry about this because we haven't got the old version yet. So this happens in the industry, and you get these servers that are just left there running for months or even years without getting updated. This is the thing that you should probably think about when you consider moving that workload under Hyper-V. There are ways to do this. There are ways to do physical to virtual for Linux machines that are fairly easy to do and get your workloads under Hyper-V. But once the workload is there, you need to figure out how to get the best performance that's in there. And there's like reading the documentation that's out there right now would help you. I think that's about it. If there's anything else, and we have time at the end for a Q&A, we'll gladly do it. But I'll just let Jason take over from here.
All right. Thanks, Tudor. So it's a good example of a lot of scenarios that happen in the field. That, you know, in some cases we hear about, we look at the forums and we talk to customers, sometimes we don't. So a critical thing here for Microsoft is, you know, number one, we're learning. We're learning about not just Linux from a technology perspective, but also usage and the types of scenarios that we need to support better, whether it's at a core fundamental platform enablement level or from a solutions level. So it's really important for us as we try to reach out to our customers and our partners to understand, to get that feedback so we can really plan accordingly and try to address accordingly as well. Okay, so that's Linux. Let's talk about FreeBSD for a minute. So the first question you might ask is, well, why do I care about FreeBSD, right? So first thing is, for those of you that raised your hands about running Linux, how many of you actually manage or run FreeBSD workloads in your environment? Okay, well, actually more than I thought. That's good. Okay. So for the folks that don't, why do we care about FreeBSD? Well, the first scenario is that a lot of virtual appliance vendors use FreeBSD. For the virtual appliances. And the reason has to do with, there's multiple reasons. One is it tends to be viewed as a more stable kernel and release process, but also the licensing enables virtual appliance vendors to be able to do a lot of innovation on top of the kernel and kind of release their own version of the OS without having to upstream it. And that allows them to be able to differentiate, which makes a lot of sense. So we see a lot of virtual appliance vendors that use FreeBSD. We also hear from our customers, they hate the fact that they have to use multiple hypervisors in their environment. So in the effect that you're actually using virtual appliances or have physical appliances and moving over to a virtual mode, if we don't have good Hyper-V support for that operating system, then you're still stuck in a mixed hypervisor environment. So we're trying to get to that end goal of being able to provide you a single hypervisor to manage your environment. And then back to the virtual appliance aspect of that as well, it's important for us as we work with our partners like Citrix and NetApp and so on that want to bring their virtual appliance offerings into Azure to enable them to do that, since Azure effectively at the fundamental platform level relies on Hyper-V. So these things are all intertwined together. But really at the end of the day, from a business perspective, customer feedback standpoint, it's really in the virtual appliance side. But also the benefit for folks that actually use FreeBSD for other functions would be able to take advantage of this as well. So let's talk about how the BSD integration services development model works. It's a little bit different than Linux integration services. First of all, there is no BSD integration services package or download like we do for Liz. The reason being is there are not, for the most part, multiple distros of FreeBSD that are out there. You have the FreeBSD Foundation that manages the FreeBSD kernel and the OS release itself. And then what happens is folks will take that release and the virtual appliance vendors do this, and then they do their innovation on top of that, and then they release their appliance, and it's very customized at that level. So we work closely with the FreeBSD community, or I should say we exclusively upstream our innovations into the FreeBSD release as needed. Now, having said that, we do provide ports for some older versions, right? So that would require you to then go ahead and include that into your OS and have to recompile, but it's not an installable package per se. But we work very closely to get these changes upstream. And then the support process is a little bit different. It can go to, actually, I should say it goes three ways. It can go to, you know, the FreeBSD community. You can file bugs up on Bugzilla, and then we triage and so on and manage for the component owners. They can go through Microsoft support. I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute. But also, if you're running on a virtual appliance and you're having fundamental issues there, your virtual appliance vendor would work with you on what the troubleshooting issues might be, and if it happens to be something related to Hyper-V, then they would work with us on that. So that's effectively how we work and distribute our updates from a BSD integration services perspective. So let's talk about what our support is today. So we've had a 1.0 release of FreeBSD integration services now for, I think almost 2 years now. Maybe a little bit less than 2 years. And it enables you effectively to provision a VM on Hyper-V, and it will run. But it's lacking a lot of the core support necessary to enable reasonable I/O. And as a result, it's supported kind of on a best effort basis from Microsoft customer support. So very similar to where we were with Linux integration services about 4+ years ago, just at the very entry phase. But we've done a lot of work, or in fact doing a lot of work right now to get up to speed and to get to a point where we're closing the gap with Linux. So we're working on Integration Services 2.0 right now, and we're targeting FreeBSD, I say 10.x. From a schedule perspective, it's probably going to be 10.2, and we'll provide ports down to 10.1. But really for FreeBSD Head, which is the next version as well. And what we're doing there is we're really trying to get the core platform enabled. So that really is number one. We've done a lot of work on the VM bus side to enable multi-channel support, so storage and networking drivers can implement multi-queue and be able to distribute on multiple threads on multiple CPUs, and actually it significantly increases core performance. We've done some host guest signal optimization as well. We've also completely have rewritten the KVP driver, re-architected it, and updated the KVP daemon as well. And that's just the beginning. So there's other work that we're doing specific around the storage and networking stack I'll talk to in a minute. But the good news is that once we get this core work done, we provide the ports available to 10.1, we'll provide more official support through Microsoft customer support services to support customers that are running those workloads. So let's talk about feature availability. On the core side, I just talked through what those core pieces are, and I say more coming soon. So what that means right now is we've had core support from a BSD 1.0 perspective, but as I talked about, it's not been phenomenal. As we take a look at 10.x and Head, that's where all these core investments are coming in that really changed the game for performance on FreeBSD. From a feature perspective, same VRSS support, TCP offload, and hot add remove NIC. We're working on those right now to get those upstream for that version as well. And as you can see right now, we've got general support across the board for some of the core pieces, other core pieces on the networking, jumbo frames, VLAN tagging, migration, and static IP injection. On the storage side, we're working right now on VHDX resize, trim support, and then a little bit further out, will be virtual fiber channel and live virtual machine backup support as well. And then on to the next slide, KVP side, so from as you can see from the rest of the slides, I should have talked through this. We provide ports from 8.4 up to 9.3. Okay, we did our first built-in of integration services at 10. But even then, for KVP as an example, it was built in, but we've provided updates to KVP and made ports available for 10 for some of the KVP work that we've done. But really, we're upstreaming right now to have KVP available for 10.x, so that work's happening right now. The last thing I want to touch on for a minute before we sign off here and go into Q&A is talking about FreeBSD and Azure. I didn't talk about Linux and Azure so much. There'll be a session tomorrow that goes into detail. So if you're interested in what our options are for running Linux and Azure, for example, Jason Zander announced that we now have CoreOS support up in Azure, which is great. Gabby Lang will be doing a session tomorrow to go through in detail how we support Linux in Azure. FreeBSD in Azure, while not officially supported, is actually now becoming available through a channel called VM Depot. VM Depot is run by a subsidiary of Microsoft called Microsoft OpenTech, and it's where community members get together and create images and upload directly into the VM Depot area that you can provision directly into Azure yourself, or if you want, you can actually just take a download or a deployment script and then deploy it through Azure PowerShell. What's interesting here is that FreeBSD has committed to working with us on providing future releases of FreeBSD will be made available on VM Depot going forward. So as they come out with new releases, they're going to show up. And we're also working with them to make them available as a part of the new Azure Marketplace that was just announced 2 days ago as well. So that's one way to get FreeBSD in Azure. The other way is there's a process to bring your own FreeBSD into Azure, just as you can for Linux today, which requires to do some configuration options, installing our Python Linux agent, which actually works with the Azure Fabric Controller and communicates with Azure to get it running in Azure. But I did want to show you really quick how cool and easy it is to do this. So let me switch over to see if I get the right one here. Oh, no, it's this one. Okay. There we go. Okay. So provisioning a FreeBSD in Azure from VMDepot is actually really, really simple. And this is just something that the team just updated recently. Before, it was a little bit more complicated. You had to do a deployment script. Now you can actually provision directly without even having to go to the portal. So let me show you how that works. So you can see here that there is an RC3 of 10.1 by FreeBSD.org that's been released. So I'm logged into VMDepot with my Azure or with my Windows Live account, which happens to be my Azure account as well. What also I've done that I won't show you here is I've downloaded my Azure Publish Settings file, and I've associated my machine with the VMDepot website. So I can now, on behalf of myself, I can go ahead and deploy and provision directly without having to do any additional authentication. So I'm going to go ahead and click the Create Virtual Machine button here. Okay. So what I can do here now is I can go ahead and customize as needed. So let's go ahead and add my unsecure password, which it's going to complain about. And then you basically get the core options here that you would have up in the Azure portal. So I can go through and I can change the name. I can change the VM size, and I'm going to make it down to a smaller VM because it doesn't need that much power. I'm going to change my region to Asia because that's where I live. And I'm going to create a new storage account. And, oh, more important thing, make sure I choose the correct subscription I want to use. And I'm going to go ahead and create that live virtual machine after I agree to the terms and conditions, of course. Let's go ahead and create that VM. What am I missing here? Oh, it doesn't like my password. I don't think they match. Let me try this one more time. Okay, there's that. Okay, there we go. Now it's scheduling the VM deployment. So now it's going ahead and through PowerShell on the back end, going ahead and uploading the image into my storage account and provisioning the VM. It's that simple. So you can see that's actually going ahead and doing the work. So let's pop over to the Azure portal, and let's see if the Azure portal is actually showing this now. So let's take a look at my virtual machines. Let's refresh the portal here. It was idle, and it looks like it logged me out. Great security feature, actually. Okay. Has anybody here had a chance to, that's been using Linux or FreeBSD, had a chance to use it in Azure yet? Show hands, anybody? Couple? Okay. The new portal experience is actually fantastic and makes things a lot simpler. Okay, so let's take a look here and see where, it looks like it's not there yet. Let's go back to here and see where we're at. It's in the process of loading cargo, but this is going to show up here in a second. So, let's wait for it to see. So while that's going, we'll pop back to it in a second. Let me go ahead and close out here real quick. So in summary, I'm just going to repeat the slide that I started with, and actually I'm going to end then just with this slide in summary. This effort that we're working on is super important to Microsoft. In order for us to be able to really extend the level of support and keep our enterprise customers happy and working with us, this is necessary. And then even taking it a step further and providing that level of support and an extended level of support and features and functionality in Azure is even more important. So we're spending a lot of time here, and I'd ask you if you please provide us your feedback. This is an area again that we are learning, and we want to do the work that's really necessary to enable our customers to make sure that we've got a great situation and story here. So thanks for that. And with that, a couple of sessions I talked about: the running Linux and FreeBSD in Azure session. That'll be tomorrow at 3:15, and then also we have an Ask the Experts Linux session. It's going to be during the, I don't know what the session, the Ask the Expert session, which is down in the main hall. It'll be actually just after that that session at around 6:30, and that'll just be kind of an open Q&A session. Links of interest. This is a new link here. We've just updated with FreeBSD support, but this link here really is going to give you more detail on our feature matrix for each distro version of Linux and FreeBSD that we support and where the feature matrix is at. So if you're interested in learning more, that's a great place to go. And then in general resources that you've seen in probably every presentation so far. And with that, I'd ask you to please complete an evaluation for the session. And with that, we're going to go ahead and just close down. So if we've got a few more minutes. You can, if you've got questions, feel free to step up and ask questions. Or if you want to run down to lunch before the line gets crazy, you can do that as well. So thank you very much. Appreciate it.